How well will that non-human survive, though, as the climate changes? And Ted, this is your topic for us today.
It is, yes. There were two very interesting papers came out last month, both by Australia, led by Australian researchers, and taken together, they tell a fascinating story. Although at first sight, you'd think they're quite different. The first one was about the rate at which species are moving in response to climate change. So it was a group of about 40 researchers led by a researcher, Greta Peckel from Institute for Marine and Antarctic Studies here in Hobart.
We know her from REDMAP.
That's right.
Do yeah. we? Which is yeah. a great piece of citizenship science, watching where the fish are all going.
That's right. Well, she and others convened a conference a little while ago called Species on the Move. And what they've done since with there's some 40 authors on this paper, is sweep up studies from around the world that have looked at how plants and animals are moving in response to climate change. And there were two things that stand out from that study. One is that that plants and animals on land are moving at an average of 17 kilometres a decade towards the poles, and in the ocean, 78 kilometres a decade to cooler water and towards the poles. So there's a general movement towards cool areas. On land, there's also a movement up in elevation, so species that are that require a certain temperature. So like coffee is, where coffee will now successfully grow is getting slightly higher and higher in elevation.
This worried me because I had a look at that article that a phrase even exists called the coffee apocalypse. There we go. It's such an awful thing to think. I can barely say it. That in fact the band within which coffee grows is shrinking and may disappear. Potentially.
Could
it go so far up the hill there'd be no coffee?
But this is where it gets interesting. So humans throughout our history have both modified ourselves to suit the world and modified the world to suit ourselves. And if you look at the history of agriculture, it's all about changing species, modifying them. So artificial selection. The first couple of chapters of Darwin's Origin of Species are about agricultural plants and animals, how we've changed them to suit ourselves. And we continue to do that. So that's where it is like the Red Queen hypothesis, that you have to run fast to stay where you are. So the thing to do will be selecting for varieties of coffee that are more tolerant of higher temperature. And the question is, can we do that quick enough?
We'll do that for that plant because we value that crop.
Yep.
But meanwhile, there's going to be a bunch of other plants that
we
don't know the fate of. We won't be involved in that.
And they may be intimately connected with our lifestyle or our economy. They may pollinate crops and plants. They may pollinate our crops. They may carry disease. There's a whole lot. The interesting thing about this is new communities are forming of different species as they move and bump into each other, forming novel communities that we have not experienced before. And it's very difficult to tell what the consequences will be.
So you get new predators on new plants.
Yeah, like the sea urchins that moved down the east coast of Tasmania are now munching on the kelp beds and creating those urchin barrens. The crabs are moving into Antarctic waters, and there are species of mollusks and other things there that have had no evolutionary experience of a great big predator with claws. So things are shifting around. It's not all gloom and doom, though. Pasture growth in Tasmania is likely to increase. There's huge increase in mackerel around Iceland. There are new species of recreational fish and commercial fish are appearing in different places. You know, so there are winners and losers. But the other significant thing in that paper was the fact that they could find no reference in national strategies or budgets or development plans that acknowledges this shift in species. It still hasn't really pierced the awareness at the level of politics and planning and budgets. But the other paper that presents a very interesting contrast to this is a study of the arrival of the first Australians. So the University of Adelaide has a collection of hair samples that were collected with permission from Aboriginal people between 1920 and 1970. And there's now a technique called mitochondrial DNA, which is DNA passed down through the mother only, which alters at a very predictable rate. So it presents a form of molecular clock. And what they did is look at all these samples.
So it's kind of like carbon dating.
It is, carbon dating for humans.
But more accurate, I think.
It is very accurate. Yeah. And what they did is they've established that the first people to arrive in Australia did so about 49,000 years ago across the land bridge from New Guinea. and then very rapidly spread down the east and west coast. Within 2,000 years, they were right down at the bottom, the southernmost part of Australia, which is extremely fast. But the other interesting thing is, where different groups settled, they then stayed for the duration.
It's 22/7 ABC Radio Hobart. You're listening to Ted Lefroy. He's the director for the Centre for Environment at the University of Tasmania. And every few weeks he comes in and gets your mind going on a Monday, looking at the latest in environmental research and what that might mean and the implications that might have, just about how you understand your place in the world, but also in the case of where all the food's moving, government policy and those sorts of implications. And this story is so interesting about culture. One of the things I love is that one group went left and one went right.
Yeah.
But then they stayed.
Where they arrived. And the thing is, they got right around Australia within 2,000 years. And then the groups, as they settled around the coast, stayed there until, essentially stayed there throughout some of the most dramatic climate change Australia has seen. So when they arrived, Australia was going into an ice age, right, which peaked about 20,000 years ago when temperatures were about 10 degrees cooler than they are now. So now about a third of Australia is desert. Over half of it was desert then. Imagine it being cold, dry and very windy. So all the dune fields were created at this time. Then about 15,000 years ago, it started to warm up and it took about 3,000 years to get to current temperatures. Now, that's fairly rapid. So a change, 10 degrees increase in temperature in 3,000 years. But what is interesting is people didn't move in response to that. They stayed where they were and adapted. And that's a huge amount of adaptation.
So they changed what they ate?
Their technology.
How they hunted?
Yep. They must have. I mean, that's the implication of the story, that people got to certain places. There's a place called Devil's Lair near Margaret River in Western Australia. And there's records of Aboriginal people there 48,000 years ago. So that's 1,000 years from when they first arrived. People had settled there. And the genealogical study tells us that those groups stayed in that place and changed. But the other interesting aspect of the story is, as temperatures warmed up and became much more like today, there was a population increase. And what they can tell from the archaeological evidence as well as the genetic evidence is that there was a decrease in mobility and an increasing reliance on technology. So there was a boom in certain new types of technology, seed grinding, different types of tools, as well as culture, language, different art forms, all appear just as temperatures warm up and things really start to get interesting. So what it's telling us is that as well as altering the environment and managing it through fire, there was tremendous ability to change themselves. There must have been dietary adaptation. So it doesn't mean that we're out of the woods in the present. It just means that humans have continually confronted this sort of challenge. What's different now is the size and interconnectedness of our populations.
And I suppose it's also a difference between culture and civilization and the animal populations. The animal populations just have to keep moving with where the water is. So they're adapting too in terms of finding new sources of food. New
exactly. And our big challenge is not evolutionary in terms of our biological evolution, but our cultural and technological evolution. And, you know, one of the things, we now have these things called cities and infrastructure, and we're not as mobile. We can't follow our food around. Our food comes to us. But what's going to have to happen is dramatic changes in culture and institutions and trade and technology in order to keep up with the fact that plants and animals are all shifting around in response to climate. We're pretty much rooted to the place. But that's what I found fascinating about this Aboriginal study. So when Aboriginal people talk about relationship to country, you know, it has real meaning, doesn't it, if people stayed in the same place, possibly longer than any other communities. And this really inverts the idea of tenure. They belong to the country, not the other way around.